from retipster.com. This is the RE Tipster Podcast. This show is all about using your limited time and energy to invest in real estate with lower risk and bigger rewards. If you want to build more financial freedom from real estate without putting your life savings on the line, this show is for you.
Hey there, everybody. How's it going? This is Seth Williams from the RE Tipster Podcast, and welcome to today's episode. In this episode, I'm sitting down with my good friend, Chad Carson. Chad runs a website over at coachcarson.com, and Chad is somebody that I have known about for a few years, and I actually just met him for the first time in person this past November at a conference, and we got to talk a little bit, and I found that he's just a really cool, down-to-earth guy, like somebody that I just genuinely enjoy talking to and spending time around. And something that Chad has been working on for quite a while now is writing a book that is getting published with Bigger Pockets. If you're at all familiar with BiggerPockets.com, chances are you already know about it. It's just a huge, massive real estate investing website and social platform. And Chad's writing a book for them. And it's getting published on, I believe the published date is August 23. And the book is called Retire Early with Real Estate. And in this interview, we're just going to talk a little bit more about the whole premise behind this book and some of the ideas and concepts that he talks about and just his whole take on real estate investing and lifestyle design and how he runs his business. So without further ado, I'm going to jump into this interview and you can listen in. Hope you enjoy it. Chad, how you doing?
Awesome, Seth. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. So Chad, you know, I've known of Chad for a few years now. Finally got to meet him in person at FinCon 2017 this past year, and just a really cool guy. I mean, I don't know, you know, there's something wrong with you if you don't like this guy. He's just super down to earth, super knowledgeable. He has a lot of great experience with real estate, and he's a great educator as well. Chad runs a website. Is it CoachCarson.com? Is that right?
That's right. Yep. CoachCarson.com.
Okay. Yeah, you bet. And Chad has also been on a lot of the same podcasts that I've been on, including you've been on Bigger Pockets. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
I got me started.
Yeah.
And we both got our start there with the blogging and some podcasts. So yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a great network to be plugged into. And Chad has also just put together a book that is being published on behalf of Bigger Pockets as well, which I believe it's called, is it Retire Early with Real Estate? Am I getting that right?
That's it. Okay. Yeah, Retire Early with Real Estate, and coming out August 23rd, 2018.
Sweet. Sounds good. And Chad, for those of out there who don't know you, can you tell us what is your backstory? Like, how did you get into real estate? Where are you coming from in that realm?
Sure. Yeah. So about 16 years ago now, from where we're talking today, I got started with real estate, and I started right after college, actually. So it wasn't really something I expected. I tell people it was an accident, but I wasn't expecting to stay with the business. And so I basically became a full-time investor and then also invested for retirement as well. So I think that's kind of the distinction. You know, people get into the business. Some people are just doing it on the side, you know, part-time hustle. Other people are getting into it full-time, and kind of like you, I do both. When I first started getting out of college, I was a biology major in college, studied German, played football. So like, I really wasn't like going down this path deliberately, but I knew my father and mother had invested in rental properties in the past. And I wasn't really, you know, thinking that's what I wanted to do, but I read a couple books that they had on the shelf and I thought, yeah, this is pretty interesting. And I was applying to med schools, but didn't really want to jump into that right away. I wanted a kind of a break. And so I decided to see if I could learn how to flip houses for a year or two. And I figured that would help me out long run. I could always use that. And so one thing led to another. I got addicted to the entrepreneurship lifestyle and having flexibility and freedom and the challenge of it. And so I just kept with it and stayed with it. And started off kind of flipping houses to other people, like you teach people, you know, wholesaling and buying low, selling a little bit higher. then got into more flipping houses by fixing them up and flipping them. And I have a business partner at that point. So we've been doing business together for 15 years now. And eventually, as we saved some money and got a little bit of a foundation, we started buying more buy and hold income properties. And I'm in a college town, so Clemson, South Carolina. And so eventually we bought single family houses that we rent to families, and we still do that. But we also started getting some small multi-units that we rent to students, primarily grad students, and kind of the lower price part of the college student rental market. And so that's become a niche for us as well, is doing those long-term buy and hold multi-unit properties where we buy them, fix them up, turn them around, raise the rents, and then hold them typically long run for cash flow.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And why don't you tell us a little bit about this book that you've been writing, Retire Early with Real Estate. I mean, that's seems like a pretty general but pretty hot topic that a lot of people are very interested in. I know I certainly was and am. It's just a big deal to be able to, you know, live a sustainable lifestyle from the income that's coming in from rental properties and other types of real estate investments. Do you like teach people how to do real estate investing in this book, or is it like teaching philosophy or concepts, or what's it all about?
Yeah, so you and I both know that real estate's a big umbrella. So, you know, you've got part of it, you have tactics. You can get into the details of, hey, here's how you do a direct mail piece and make sure you get a good response on that. And then there's also like more the strategy of like, all right, here, and I compare it to the book is based on metaphor, where you as the person who is interested in real estate and you're interested in retiring early, which I want to go back to that, what that means in a second. But, you know, getting out of the rat race of working a job and being dependent on job income is kind of my main goal, is helping people get out of that cycle. And so you're somebody who wants to do that. And let's say you're 30 years old and you decide, hey, I'm working this job. 10 years from now, I'd like to at least have the flexibility to either go part time or leave my job or just working at my job and not need the income. And so how do you do that? What's the strategy? And I compare that to climbing a mountain. So, you know, you're down here at the bottom of the mountain. The peak of the mountain is this financial independence, this point where you can live off your rental income or your real estate income. And so how do you do that? And so I do that by kind of sharing a few main strategies. So buy and hold real estate, using debt snowballs to pay your loans down and get properties free and clear, trading up with 1031s. Or those are a few of like the main kind of, you could think of them as paths up the mountain. But then also I sprinkle in there, I was really fun. I got to interview a lot of people, including you, asking questions about how did other investors do that? Because I had one experience and I wanted to get outside of my own, you know, one path and say, all right, how did other people do it? What were they thinking about? And it was so fascinating to learn from people like you and Paula Pant and other people that you know, people haven't heard of, just other investors who've used rental properties in kind of novel ways. And showed, you know, what did they need? How much income did they need? What was it like to live off rental income? What was it like to build wealth? And so I learned a lot just from writing the book of just clarifying what it's like for people to use real estate. And it's convinced me more than ever that this is just, if you're using this to try to build wealth and produce income, it's pretty much the best game going, I think. There's other ways to retire and there's more traditional ways, but this is an awesome way. This, you know, real estate is very flexible. You can use it as a job to make money right now. You can use it as a wealth builder, and you can use it as an income generator to pay for your bills the rest of your life. And it's such a flexible vehicle. And that's really what the point of the book was, is to show the strategy of how you use this vehicle and give you some different ways that you could kind of pick yourself out and say, yep, I'm like that. I want to use that strategy. And then when you go start setting all the tactics and the details, it'll fit within a bigger context of how to retire early with real estate.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I know, you know, I've sort of had this experience in my own life, and I've had several friends who are, you know, they own, you know, really many, many rental properties, and they kind of come to a point where they have this like disappointing realization of, like, I'm just thinking of an example off the top of my head. I have a friend and he owns, I think, 8 rental units, and he's been super diligent about finding these deals and getting properties that cash flow and, you know, keeping them up and all that. And it's hard to live off these things. He's got a really good job with a really good income that pays him very well, has great benefits. And, you know, every time he tries to think about seriously pulling the plug from this job and living on the rental properties, it's kind of like, man, I don't think I can do that, because all it takes is for one of these rentals to need a new roof or a new furnace, and it just wipes out my income for the whole year. And this income is there, but like, I never really know if it's going to be there because I have these other problems that can come up. And I know that that's a dilemma a lot of people have. And I'm just curious, like, how do you get past that? Like, how many rentals do you need, or how much income do you need before it's okay to pull the plug on your job? And how do you, do you need more than just rental properties? Like, I know I look at myself, like my rental portfolio is just one of many sources of income that I have. It's not my only thing. And I know you're, from what I know of you, you know, you've lived in Ecuador, other parts of the world, and you've got a pretty healthy rental portfolio that's supporting you. How do you do that? Can you explain a little bit more about your thoughts on how that works?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question because I think one of the concepts that I've realized myself, because I thought I would be able to live off my rental income a lot earlier than I did. I mean, I've been doing this 15 or 16 years now, and it really wasn't until 3 or 4 years ago, and after we got through the down cycle of the real estate market, which is another thing that we all have to deal with in real estate, to where I really felt confident that that money was there, because I was like your friend. You know, I would have, all right, I think I've got this income coming in. It worked for 9 months, and then I'd have a big vacancy and I had to invest money in it. And so I think the big concept I learned was that real estate is absolutely not a like overnight kind of thing. It's rental properties are, it's kind of like you hear people talk about businesses and startups, how they usually don't make money for the first year or two, if at all. Well, real estate is like an ultra slow startup. It's something where it's probably going to take 10 years before you really have a stable portfolio that generates rental income that you can be confident in. And why is that? One reason is because what you said, there's a lot of capital expenses that sort of work themselves out over time. So roofs, heating and air, those sorts of things. But at this point, we've sort of, not that it's perfect, but we've got a point where we have a schedule and we say, all right, every year we look at our properties. We say here, these properties probably need roofs in 5 or 10 years. Here, these properties need heating and air, like all the big expenses. And we start estimating those and we actually budget those and say, all right, you know, here are our normal maintenance. We've got some good records for the last, you know, for many years. We need to set aside this much money additional for these kind of capital expenses. And so I think it's a budgeting thing. I think all of us, it's not just your friend, it's me as well as everybody, we kind of have a kind of a clouded vision of what the numbers are going to look like. And so I think as you stabilize, as you get 5, 10 years into this, you really see what your properties are going to, how they're going to perform, and then you can estimate for the future better based on that. That's one thing. The other thing is I think capital structure is really important. So what does your debt to equity ratio look like? And I've kind of gone back and forth on this because there's advantages to keeping some leverage. There's advantages to having properties free and clear. And this is a hot debate, you know, in real estate circles. Yeah. Like some people is like adamant, you will not pay off debt. That's crazy. Yeah. You know, why would you pay off a 4% loan? And other people are saying, don't ever use a loan. Like those are the extremes. Yeah. And I've sort of settled into the fact that if you at least get a part of your portfolio free and clear of real estate, and let's just use it a real number. Let's say you had 20 properties in the end, and you had, you know, 5 or 10 of them free and clear, and another 5 or 10, you know, still had some long-term safe mortgages. What that does for you is it reduces your risk because it reduces the risk if the market falls out from under us, if rents drop, if we have another Great Depression, you have some stability there. But you also have, you've increased your income. You know, you were paying a bank $500 per month or $600 per month in a mortgage payment on those 10 properties. If you get those loans paid off, that's 10 times 500. That's another $5,000 in cash flow. And you're basically taking the bank's place and you're increasing your cash flow. And so we've done that gradually over time. We still have some leverage as well, but just it's a great, I found it a great way to reinvest your money. Like let's say you get a big chunk of cash from a flip over here, or you sell your business, or you get a big bonus at work. You know, that's a automatic place where you can put some really low risk money. You pay off a 5% loan or a 6% loan. That's like putting your money in a bond or a, you know, really safe savings account, and you're increasing your cash flow, you're reducing your risk. And so I've kind of, the people I've studied in this retirement book is I've seen a lot of people have these very simple portfolios with low debt ratios or very safe leverage ratios, high cash flow, and they're living pretty stable because of that nice capital structure they built.
Yeah. I like that, man. That's really cool. I know what you mean. I've heard different voices out there lately talking about how, you know, you are a fool if you pay off debt. Like, it's just ridiculous, which totally flies in the face of what I was raised to believe and to think. Right. Like, you're supposed to pay off every last piece of debt whenever possible. And I see both sides. I really do. And I don't know, that just makes a lot of sense to me, having a portion of your portfolio be free and clear and having another portion be the leverage growing. I'm just curious, when you say that, like, what portion of your overall portfolio do you think should be free and clear in a perfect world? Like half or a third or a quarter of it? Or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, if we simplified it, I think you put people, you'd ask a person, like, what's your risk portfolio? Like, what is your risk profile? I consider myself pretty, you know, I'm an entrepreneur, I've taken risk. And so I'm not as risk averse maybe as some people are. Like, you know, Dave Ramsey on one extreme, you know, he went bankrupt in real estate, actually doing what we do. But he borrowed way too much and he had commercial debt. And so I think he's like super risk averse. And there are people like him who relate to him. And I think that's fine. They would have, you know, 0% leverage, 20% leverage. For me, like, my long-term stable goal at this point is to have about 30, like a third leverage. Right now we're more like at 50%, and I'm not like in a hurry to do that. We used to be at 70%. You know, that's, so I think that the place we've gone overall is 70% to 50% long run. I think we can want to continue to get lower, but we made a decision a few years ago. We had a big chunk of capital from selling some properties and saving some money. And the idea was, all right, we could go and pay down a bunch of debt, go from 50% to 30%. Or if we have another opportunity come along, if we see some really good properties, and this was 2016 when we were doing that, we could reinvest it. Like, which one should we do? And we decided that we would just be really disciplined with the criteria that we would buy from. And if we found a really good deal that had a lot of good upside and it was not risking the whole ship, we could then go buy that property. And that, we made that decision. We actually bought a 28-unit property that had some development potential long run and had good cash flow once we raised the rents. And so I think it was a good decision. We still have more leverage than maybe we could have, you know, been even more low, you know, low debt and low risk. But I think for us in our position, it was probably the right decision. And now we have extra cash flow and extra equity. So, but I think it's a personal decision. That's one thing I tried to convey in the book, is that, you know, my way is not your way. Like, there are a few different paths up the mountain. There are different risk profiles. We're all a bit different. And so your job, all of us, is to pick our, you know ourselves, and then pick within the huge umbrella of real estate, the strategy and the kind of risk profile that you want to take. And it's okay. You know, it can work. There's people who make it work every single way. It might take a little bit longer taking one path, but then later on it might go faster. And so I just wanted to give people an idea of, like, here's what you can do. Here's what I've done. Here's what Seth's done. Here's what this other person's done. You know, find yourself there, and then kind of put a plan together.
Yeah. No, that's cool, man. I like that. Just on a personal note with myself, you know, I've sort of been going back and forth for years now about whether or not to pay off my personal residence. So this is not something that's generating income for me. It's purely, I guess, as some would call it, bad debt. Like, it's not putting any money in my pocket. It's just costing me. Right. And maybe it's dumb for me to own my own home in the first place. I don't know. That's up for debate too. But where I'm at now, do you think it's smart to pay off my mortgage, or should I be saving my cash to plow that into properties that are going to produce income for me?
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you, Seth. We have a mortgage on our house, and my wife and I, you know, go back and forth on this, because we have a 3% mortgage. It's, you know, 15 years. It's really, you know, the property's worth 200 and we owe 80 or 90,000. So it's like, oh man, you know, this is not, it's not the smart thing to do, like, as an investor who's trying to grow your portfolio. But I'm sort of, and this is a debate we can just talk about, you know, like, one of the arguments for paying it off for us is that growth is not the priority as much for us anymore. Like, I still want to grow. Like, I'm 38 years old. We've got a lot of time, and growth is certainly important. But, you know, there's this pendulum of growth versus safety and hassle, no, low hassle. And, you know, I've got young kids. And so more and more, my pendulum has been swinging towards low hassle, low risk, increasing my flexibility and time. Like, this trip I took to Ecuador was all made possible because I was spending a little bit of time on real estate and a lot of time on these other things, and I still had income coming in.
Yeah.
And so, like, for my house, I'm kind of leaning towards paying it off at some point. Although I have other days where I'm like, you're crazy. You know, you've got, and I think it might come down to, and again, like, if I have just a easy, this is a no lose kind of real estate deal that falls in my lap, and I've got $80,000 set aside to buy it, and I could go buy this property and own that rental free and clear and have a really good income producing property that pays for my mortgage and then some, I might make the decision not to do it. But if more and more, you know, like this is kind of interesting part about the market cycles. You know, I've been back for a few weeks from Ecuador, and I'm looking at properties, and even compared to 2016, you know, you can notice that the market is much tighter. It's a little bit harder in my area, at least, to buy good deals. The cap rates are lower. So if I go out there and look and can't find any deals that are reasonable, that makes me even more likely to pay off debt, because then I have a guaranteed return. I have low risk. I'm not having to chase returns on where I'm really feel like I'm not compensated for the risk of taking that, putting my money in something. So again, I think it comes down to like personal preference, which I kind of explain my personal preference. I'd be curious to hear yours too. But then also like what's the layout of the market look like for you? Like, are there deals available? Are you out hustling and finding great properties? If you are, then, you know, maybe that cash could be better put to use somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like financially speaking, I guess when you can just come down to like doing the math and the numbers, like it probably does not make the most sense to pay off my mortgage, but
right.
I still want to. Like it's like it goes beyond financial matters. It's more of like a psychological peace of mind thing. Like I just want to know that nobody can ever take this house away from me. Like if the bottom falls out, if the market crashes, if every business endeavor that I'm working on just suddenly fails overnight. Mm-hmm. Granted, I don't know what the chances are of that ever happening, but you never know. I mean, crazy stuff can happen. And if the worst ever happens, like, it's okay. Me and my family, we still have a roof over our heads and nothing's going to happen to that. Yeah. And I think there's like almost an unquantifiable value to that because, you know, just the whole peace of mind thing. And, you know, I realize there's ways I can make more money, but you can kind of always make that argument. Like no matter what kind of returns you get on anything, there's always like, oh, but what if? There's this other thing that I could have done better on. So I don't know. It's one of those, it's kind of like the baseline, like the foundation of like, I just want to stop this bleeding and then I can go crazy with other stuff.
I like it.
So I don't know. But I don't, you know, I think it's fine if people have other philosophies, kind of like what you were saying. Like it's not wrong to think differently than I do, but that's sort of just where my thought process leads me to.
I like it. Yeah. It reminds me, Seth, of like, you know, why do we buy insurance? You know, we buy life insurance and things like that to give us some peace of mind. It's sort of like that. It's like some of this emotional financial decision to say, you know, it's not the best thing. I'm having to spend money on this insurance and I'm probably never going to make any money off of this. But at the same time, it gives me peace of mind. So yeah, I think you convinced me, Seth. I think you pushed me over the edge.
Awesome. Well, I know, one of the things you mentioned in your book is, I think you say you don't like the word retirement. You prefer the words financial independence. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So a lot of the people, myself, I'm writing to myself and I'm writing to other people who are, you know, in their 30s and their 40s. And for all of us, I think this idea that we're going to go and we get to 65 and we retire and we move to Florida or to the beach and just kind of sit back and drink pina coladas is like, that's just not a thing anymore. I think most of us, particularly people who are ambitious enough to go buy properties and build this income stream, like we have other things we want to do in our life, and it might be work. It might be, you know, for all of us, it is work. Like I enjoy work. I enjoy projects. And so like retirement, even the word retirement means like to leave, to like, you know, retreat, to go away. And that's not really what this financial goal is about. Most of us want to have this peace of mind that we know the income's taken care of, kind of like we were talking about with the house. Like we know that base is taken care of. Now we can go and do things that matter. Like we can go find out. And that's so personal that, you know, for me, it was at this point in my life, it was traveling with my kids and being able to spend more time in a foreign country and learn a foreign language and, you know, all my meals with my kids and getting to know my kids better and not be running on this rat race. You know, that was important to me. 10 years from now, 15 years from now, there might be something else. And that's been one thing, fun thing I've had being a blogger, just hear all of the different stories. Like, why do people want to invest in real estate? Why do they want to make money? And it's everything. It's from taking care of my mother. It's taking care of my kids. It's contributing to this nonprofit. It's starting this business that I've never always wanted to do and I haven't been able to do it. It's working in this different job that makes less money, but I really want to do it. I mean, like teachers are a great example. Like teachers are so underpaid for the value they give to society. You know, think about a middle school teacher, a high school teacher, how important that is, elementary school. And there are people who are teachers who are working a finance job because it pays three times more money. And they should be teachers. There's preachers. There's all sorts of like that's really the purpose behind, for me at least, making money. And so like when you finally get to this point of financial independence, it's you're independent from the need to work for money. Now, what do you want to do with your life? It's wide open. You're like a kid again. And I think so many of us, myself included, is we get in that kind of that track of like making money, working a job, security, that we almost like lose that imagination of saying, what do we want to do with our life? And it's, you know, first it's a little bit overwhelming, then it's exciting. And that's kind of the point I'm at now. I'm just like, all right, what next? what do I want to do? And it's, you know, I'm an entrepreneur. So for me, blogging and writing and getting to have these kind of conversations is just it's just awesome for me. But you know, that's what I hope to encourage everybody else to do is like, let's figure out that thing that you should be doing that deep down in your soul, you're like, this is it. And then let's use that as the energy to buy properties, to produce income. And then, along the way, don't wait, don't wait till you're 65. You could take little mini retirements. You could figure out a way to take off for a month from your job, maybe 2 weeks, maybe you're ambitious like me and you go away for 17 months, but like take some kind of time away with and kind of test out this theory that what you're actually wanting to do in the end is actually a good thing, because, you know, it's all an experiment. We're all having to figure this thing out as we go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you mean. It really is a shame when you see people, and there's a lot of them out there. I mean, I almost might even venture to say like the majority of people are like this, where like they don't really love what they're doing. They're kind of just like putting up with it until they can retire at age 60, whatever, or something like that. And yeah, it's man, when you think about that, like it is a shame. Like it's just really, really unfortunate. I mean, and I think what it comes down to for a lot of people is that like everybody is born with like these inherent gifts, things that they're great at. Mm-hmm. And many times those things can be monetized, but like they haven't discovered what it is yet. Like they took the safe approach, or the approach that they thought was like the wisest things that would pay the most money. And that's why like you hear of people who are doctors and making tons of money and they hate their life and they're trying to get out of it. They feel stuck, which seems kind of backwards, because like, why, you know, you work so hard to get here and you're doing so well financially. Why would you want to get out of this? Yeah. But I think it's a very, very common thing. I actually, when I was thinking about this, I remembered, apart from Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Workweek, that always kind of stuck with me. And I copied here. I'm going to try to paraphrase this, but essentially what he says in the book is, retirement as a goal or a final redemption is flawed for at least three solid reasons. First of all, it's predicated on the assumption that you don't like what you're doing during the most physically capable years of your life. And also, I mean, most people are never going to be able to retire and maintain a, as he called it, hot dogs for dinner standard of living, because even $1 million is like chump change in a world where traditional retirement can span 30 years, inflation is going nuts. Like the math just doesn't work. And even if the math does work, like let's say somehow you do find a way to save enough money to retire, it means you're probably like super ambitious and hardworking and you did a lot to get there. And, you know, if you finally get to the point where you retire, you're going to be so bored that you're going to, as he says, stick bicycle spokes in your eyes. Like it just doesn't work. So it kind of goes back to the point of like, man, like find out what you love and find ways to make it work financially, whether that means like reducing your expenses or finding ways to monetize the things you do love.
I think it's really possible for lots of people, but it takes some creativity and some risk taking to get there.
Yeah. Tim Ferriss's book was one of my inspirations for sure. The 4-hour work week. When I, in 2009, I took before my wife and I had kids, we went on a little mini retirement for 4 months. And that was basically like the kick in the pants I needed to say, all right, you need to like do this thing, like just test out this theory. But exactly what he said, like, why wait until the end of your life to see if this is what you want to do? And so we went on a backpacking trip to Spain and South America and, you know, in Peru and Argentina and Chile and Patagonia. And so, yeah, that's exactly. And it's also the point, though, like I find a lot of people who are attracted to this message, like I'm a spreadsheet nerd, you know, we did like to do math, and we're going to get all into this, like, we got to get this exact number that's going to, in the end, I'll have enough money to eliminate all of my worries, and I'll have complete security when I have this many properties, when I have this much money. And it's sort of a fallacy, because yes, we have this goal. Yes, we try to accumulate this much money, but it's also the security you get personally, knowing that I can produce income, I can have flexibility. And so to me, it's like, it's kind of a game. It's more of like, yes, you need a foundation of income. And in the book, I talk about, like, you know, what if you generated $60,000 a year in income, and from your rental properties, or maybe, you know, whatever a number is, that's like a base, like, and maybe you made $120,000 a year in your job. So you're not making the same amount as you don't need to replace your income. What you do is give yourself a base you don't need to go to work for. And then, all right, you're 40 years old, you're 45, you're 50 years old, you still got life ahead of you. Like, what do you want to do? And, you know, you and I are on the internet. We know how, like, anything, any hobby you have, you can go on the internet and make a little side hustle out of it. There's just cool ways to do it. You can podcast, you can blog. And so that's kind of what the Do What Matters part of it is. It's wide open. I mean, you've got whatever you want to do after that is available, is possible, and you can probably make money with it too. And so I kind of see real estate as like kind of like our foundation, our base, that then allows us to jump off and do all this, whatever else you want to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Now, in your book, you have a little part where you're talking about how, I think the way you word it is that massive real estate empires are not always better. And I'm curious, you know, what do you consider to be massive, and, you know, what are the downsides of having more properties, more income, and a bigger empire?
Yeah. So this is, I wrote an article about this on Bigger Pockets before I wrote the book. And it was like the most commented article I've ever received, and the most, you know, love hate kind of comments as well, because, you know, if you listen to a lot of, real estate advice, the most exciting, interesting stories are often the ones where, look at this person, they did 100 deals this year. Look at this person, they have 1,000 units.
Yeah.
You know, you ought to get big, go big or go home. Mm-hmm. And the issue I have with that is like, that's cool. Like, we're in the United States, capitalism's awesome. Like, the sky's the limit. If that's what you want to do, go for it. The thing I push back against, though, is like, you don't need that huge empire of 1,000 units, of even 100 units, like to produce the income you need to do what matters. Like, you can, let's just do some math. Like, let's say you had 10 houses that each rent for $1,000 per month. And let's just say half of the rent goes towards your operating expenses, taxes, insurance, maintenance, vacancy, management. And so you have $500 left over per house. You know, if you had 10 houses times 500, you know, every month, and if you had no debt, that's the key part. Like, if you had these properties free and clear, you know, 10 times 500, that's $5,000 per month. 5,000 per month, that's 60,000 per year. 10 houses, yeah. You know, 10 little single family houses that rent for $1,000. And for most people that I actually did a survey before the book, like, most people said, you know, 50 to 70,000 bucks a year, I would be pretty good shape. And, you know, and that's 10 houses. It's not a huge deal. And so I guess my point there is that find out what's your reason for wanting to own a bunch of properties. And if it's because that's exciting and you want to go build this big thing, you know, that's awesome. But just, I personally got into the trap. So in 2009 or in 2003, 2004, and 2005, as I was getting my business started, I sort of borrowed goals from other people. I've watched a person who was flipping 50 houses a year, and I said, oh, they're flipping 50 houses a year. Each house they made $20,000. So that's 50 times 20,000. That's $1,000,000. Oh, that's cool. Let me go see if I can make $1,000,000 a year. And as naive as that sounds, that's we started building the business, the acquisitions funnel, the flipping houses, the people to help us. And we ended up in 2007 buying 50 properties. but it was not, we grew so fast. We did a lot of good deals and made a lot of money, but then we also had some mistakes that we made, some bad properties, some bad locations. We also had the downturn in the market right after that. So that kind of contributed. And so getting big and going there fast caused some challenges as well. And it also caused us to think about and say, you know what, why did we actually want to grow in the first place? Like, why did we want to buy and sell 50 houses in a year? Like, what's the point of this? And I start, my business partner and I actually made a list, like, what are the things we want to do that money is like helping us do? Or what would we do if money was not an issue? And it was things like, you know, I wanted to play pickup basketball in the middle of the day for 2 hours. That was like my awesome thing. I wanted to go hiking with my, you know, girlfriend at the time who became my wife. I wanted to travel abroad. And when I quantified those things, it really was not, I mean, yes, those things cost money, traveling, buying an airplane ticket, but it was like, I could go for 6 months abroad for $15,000. You know, and I could play basketball for free. But what I really needed was flexibility. I needed time, free time. And so a big, huge empire of properties, it can be done. Like, you can build it. You can eventually get it systematized. You can eventually hire people out. But it's not the easy kind of path that you think it would. There's some challenges. There's some risks that go with it. And so sometimes thinking, like, I like to ask myself the question, like, what's the simplest path I could take that would accomplish my financial goals? Because that simplest path is going to also give me more free time. It's going to give me more flexibility. And so me personally, I'm not there yet 100%, but I'm continuing to try to figure out, like, what's my simple place that I want to be at and try to get there.
Yeah. In your book, you talk about something called FIRE, which I think is from Mr. Money Mustache. Is that right?
It's that same community. Yeah. Yeah. Financial independence, retire early.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, this whole concept of retiring early, I think of somebody like, I don't know, somebody who's similar to myself where, you know, I have wife, two small children, you know, have a nice house. And if I was employed with a job that paid me enough to cover all this stuff, the idea of shunning my career sounds just ridiculous, like just a pipe dream. Like, why would I even think that? You know, there's expenses, there's obligations. I can't just snap my fingers and like walk away from my job tomorrow. If somebody is in that place and they're starting from nothing, they have no real estate, nothing going other than just their, you know, job really. What do you think is the best first step? Like, how do you get started? Like, what's the action plan that you would take if it were you to try to get to financial independence?
Yeah. So I'm sort of assuming they're motivated to do that. Like, I'm assuming that they are in that job. They don't see it as possible to leave, but they do. They're like, man, I want to do this. Like, I really, if I could do it, I would. Mm-hmm. So that's important, because that kind of burning fire, that desire to do it is great, because there's some people who say, I don't have anything I want to do. Like, I like working my job. There's nothing else I want to do. I like being able to have money to buy my cars and do stuff. And if that's you, I guess I'm not speaking to you in that case. And that's fine. But the person who is motivated, like, the first question I would ask, like, I see there's kind of two main paths. There's people who have enough time and there's people who have enough money. And so, like, if you're getting into real estate and you have a lot of extra time, let's say you're, I'm thinking about a firefighter. Like, I have some friends who are firefighters, and they got into real estate because they would have these three or four intense days per week. They were on, you know, they're working. But then they have like 5 days off. They would give them these awesome schedules. And so it was perfect. Like, they had a lot of free time to go out and make offers on properties. And so it made a lot of sense for people in that case where there's not a lot of room. Like, they like their job, but there's not a lot of room to like climb the ladder and make a lot more money in their profession, but they like doing it. And so it made more sense for them to turn real estate into a side hustle where they invest their time and energy to go out and flip some houses and make some money. So that's like one way I would say like, are you in that situation? Or are you in another situation where you have a really lucrative profession where if you're working 40 hours a week, but you could work a little bit harder, you could work extra, there's a lot of bonus potential, and you're making $100,000 now, but you could make $200,000 just with some extra effort. You know, the key here is not to like say real estate's the only vehicle and it's like the only way to make money. It's to say, like, the main thing is to get to FIRE, to get to financial independence, is to make a lot of money, to not spend that much money, and just to save a ton of money. Like, that's I told this story in the book, but I had it when I was first starting. I had a professor at Clemson University. I audited like a business class, and I met this guy who ended up being like a mentor and a private lender. And his name is Louis, Dr. Stone. So I called him, you know, Louis. he told me a story when he was 22 years old. He was working for this guy in North Carolina, and the guy said, "Hey, Louis, you know, you want to learn how to be rich?" And Louis's like, you know, 22. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'd love to learn how to be rich. And Louis said, "Louis, this is how, let me tell you how it works." He said, "Louis, first of all, you need to learn how to live on $30,000 per year and make $30,000 a year. Got it, Louis?" "Yeah, I got it. All right. So I'm going to live below my means or at my means." He said, "All right, Louis. Next step is you need to learn how to make $60,000 and still live on $30,000. Got it, Louis?" "Yeah, all right, got it. And they said, "All right, Louis, next step is you need to learn how to make $120,000 a year and still live on $30,000 a year. Got it, Louis?" "Yeah, I got it." "All right." He said, "Louis, if you can do that, you can't help but be rich." Mm-hmm. And so that's the formula. I mean, it really doesn't get any more complicated than that. Building wealth, achieving financial independence, whether you use real estate, whether you use stocks, whether you use a business, it pretty much comes down to that. And so I think like the fatal flaw that a lot of us get into is we make more money and yet we don't save the money to invest into whatever we want to invest in. So at some point, if you make $200,000 a year and if you buy the bigger house, you buy the extra cars, like I'm not making those wrong. Like I'm just saying, if you want to get to financial independence really quickly, you've got to have an enormous gap between your spending and whatever you're making, because that money is what's going to fuel the growth for your financial independence. And so going back to like our person who's getting started, like if you see that for the next 5 years, you can make $200,000 and live off 30 or 40, that might be the best thing. That might be all you need to do. Like you might not even, because all your time is spent doing that, you know, build up a big nest egg, save $200,000 or $300,000 and learn about real estate, you know, start looking at real estate, but maybe you're not going to be as aggressive with your time because that's where the most money is going to be made. If you're the firefighter or the person who has kind of a ceiling on your income and you have a lot of time or you're willing to work on the side, then, you know, go learn the business, go learn how to buy some houses, you know, study, you know, find a niche. Like what I love about your site, Seth, is that it shows how like powerful, like a very specific niche is. If you're just a generalist and you're just, you know, I just invest in real estate, like, that's not enough. Like you got to figure out some niche that you can make money in, whether that's land investing and learning from Seth, or, you know, college rentals, or flipping houses that are in older neighborhoods in a big city, or, you know, there are tons and tons of little niches. And so that firefighter is going to find on the side, like some niche, they're going to learn that niche. They're going to learn how to find good deals. They might flip a couple deals, but then they're also going to start learning how to keep some as well. And so that's over time going to, they're both going to lead to the same place. But what they're both doing is learning how to generate more income for themselves so that they can save more money, so they can invest those money in some long-term investments.
I like what you're saying about this idea of just living on way less than you make. And that's just like, it's so not sexy and it so doesn't sell stuff. But,
right.
Well, maybe it does. Dave Ramsey's doing pretty well. But, yeah. But I know in your book, you mentioned that you know, you and your family living in Ecuador for less than $3,000 a month. How is that possible? Like, is that because you're in Ecuador? Is that something a person could do in the U.S.? Or like, I don't know, what does your monthly budget look like? How does that all work out?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll be happy to share the real numbers, but like Ecuador is a little bit less expensive, but geo arbitrage is what that's called, where you live in another place, whether that's within the U.S. or internationally, where cost of living is a lot lower. But then you still make money in another place. Like I was still making dollars from the U.S. and we're living off that money in Ecuador. And so like we had a 2-bedroom apartment with $600 per month, fully furnished with utilities. Our grocery budget was probably, you know, or eating out in groceries, probably $500 or $600 a month, which, you know, by Ecuadorian standards is like we were living like kings. I mean, people make $500 per month on average there. So like, you know, when you go to some places in the world, like us making $3,000 a month or generating $3,000 a month is like, you know, we're doing pretty well. And so we were able to, I mean, we were living very well. Our kids are going to private schools, you know, buying nice food, like we would go to the local market. We had this little like kind of fresh market nearby and we would go there for $20 or $30. We would have like heapings of fruits and vegetables. Like we couldn't even carry them back, you know, for $20 or $30, all like just picked out of the garden probably this morning somewhere. So like if that's your thing, like that's going international, certainly a way to save some money. But even in the US, it's a personal preference, but there are people who make certain choices To help you live cheaper. And the number one choice, I think, is like if you look at your like the national statistics on how much people spend, about 30%, like a third basically of our budget is housing. And so like I always encourage people, like if nothing else, and you're willing and you're looking to reduce your expenses and you're willing to go out, think outside the box or live outside the box a little bit, try some kind of technique like house hacking where you live in one unit and you rent out three other units, like live in a fourplex building and live in one and rent out the other ones, or, you know, rent out a basement apartment in your house, or convert your garage to an apartment and rent that out on Airbnb. You know, if you start thinking outside the box and you can take that, you know, from a third of your budget down to like 10% of your budget. So let's just say you have a $5,000 a month budget, and you reduce, you know, your housing. Well, let's use $6,000 because $2,000 a month would be your housing bill. If you can take that $2,000 a month housing bill down to like $500, you've just saved $1,500 per month that you can then invest in other things. You can start saving that for down payments on real estate. You can whatever you want to do. And so like housing's a big one. Cars are a big one. Like I drive a 2004 Toyota Avalon, which has leather seats. It was nice in 2004. It's not super nice now, but it's going. It's fine. It works for our family. And it's a priority thing. It's thinking like I would rather buy freedom and flexibility right now in my life than I would buy the super nice car or the super fancy house. It's a priority. And it doesn't mean I don't want to drive nice cars. That doesn't mean I don't want to eat out at nice restaurants. We still do here and there, but it's that prioritization of saying, all right, if I do this, like in 5 or 10 years, I can live more flexibly. I can do this. But then the interesting thing for me is that you think you're like sacrificing and you're not happy for 5 or 10 years. And that's not the case at all. It's like you start spending your time doing things that don't cost money. You go to the park with your kids, you play, you know, play Legos, you go on, instead of going out at an expensive restaurant with your on for a date, you go on a picnic. You know, that doesn't decrease your happiness just because you aren't spending a bunch of money. I think we kind of get conditioned to that. And so it's a lifestyle. It's a kind of a mindset, but it starts with that prioritization of saying, I've got to save money. Like, what can I do to find some ways to cut the big expenses? And that's sort of what we've done.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I hear you. Our family has a similar situation. We've got, you know, four people in our family. We're kind of at a stage where, you know, our kids are really young, so they don't have like sports and stuff that we're driving them to. Right. But, you know, as a result, we have one car in our family, and it is a 2003 Buick Rendezvous. And the average person would probably be ashamed to be seen driving around in this thing. I mean, you said your car used to be nice. Ours was never nice.
It was never nice.
I'm just kidding. It was probably nice. But I mean, all this to say, it's like, frankly, I don't need to do that. It's more of a like, I don't care that much, but when you don't have to pay the price of like having to keep up with the Joneses or like look like you're rich, it frees up a lot more things in your life that, yes, that you can enjoy doing. And it's frankly, it's worth that. You know, I'm not going to remember all the great drives I had in this car, but I am going to remember the times I had with my family, you know, having breakfast with them, being able to have lunch with them and really do stuff on a Tuesday afternoon if I want to. And it goes a long way.
I agree. And I think that's been my main motivation is like, if you think about that rat, we call it a rat race for a reason, is because every time you spend money, it takes a commensurate amount of work to produce money to pay for that thing.
Yeah.
And so it's like every time you buy something, if you think about it and say, you know what, that's going to take my life energy to buy that thing. Like, and this is going to take, I'm like basically using my life energy for the next 5 years to buy that car.
Yeah.
You know, what else could I do with it? It's an opportunity cost. I could invest that in my family. I could invest that in my business. I could just do nothing. Like I could just like read a book, you know, and that's kind of what it's come down to for me. It's like you, as I said, it's not worth it. I don't have to compare myself. But that's whatever motivates you to get to do that. That's still the key. The book, The Millionaire Next Door, you know, if there's no shortcut to building wealth and retiring early, it comes down to saving that money. And If you want to do it by making $1 million and still maintaining a $200,000 lifestyle, like that's cool. Like that's the way you want to do it. But most of us, like the average person who gets there, the millionaire next door, you know, makes $100,000, $150,000 maybe, they live off $30,000 to $50,000. That's just sort of the formula for most people.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm curious, when you were living in Ecuador or anywhere else in the world, but you're real estate is somewhere else in another country, another state. How do you do? Do you have like property managers, or are you managing these yourself? How do you, you know, handle that those properties or whatever it takes to make that income continue to come in?
Right. Yeah. So for me, it's a combination. It's a combination of people and systems, and people being the number one. So we have about 90 units, and I say we because I have a business partner. So between the two of us, we have 90 units, and so we have two solutions. Like part of our properties, we have an awesome person who we has been working with us for 10 years. She started off as a bookkeeper, and we sort of trained her up, and she was interested in learning other parts of our business. And so she eventually became a person who could be like an administrative person, take customer service calls from tenants, handle maintenance calls, help us with leasing. So putting signs out and putting ads up, taking calls, getting all the application information. So she does like what I'm saying is like 90% of the leasing and property management work for us. I still, like in Ecuador, one or two hours a week, I would still pay all of our bills. So like she would enter all the bills. I would then go and look at the bills, use my online bill pay, press a button, pay the bill, ask some questions if I needed to. But it was just pretty straightforward. And so that's about, you know, 60% of our properties. And then we also hired a property manager for another piece just because it got a little bit too big for her to be able to handle all those. And so, you know, the property manager does even more. So they handle all the maintenance, they pay all the bills. And then I get a statement every month that I then go through the statement, and I still do my bookkeeping. And that's something I learned how to do bookkeeping from scratch. You know, I feel really strongly that that's no matter what, like if you're a rental property owner, like we're still the manager of those assets. We might not manage the property day to day, but I like to look at our business in numbers and say, all right, here's a spreadsheet. Our rent should be this, but it was this, and our maintenance expense was this, but it normally is like a lot lower. You know, why was our rent lower? Like, and so I go through and figure out, okay, these two properties are vacant. That's okay. They're getting turned over. This one, the person didn't pay their rent. Oh, I better ask about that. Like, is that going to be okay? Have we resolve that? And so like, that's my hour or two. I spend just looking at those kind of key metrics of the rental business and then asking questions to the people on the ground and seeing like, what's going on. And with technology today, I know I love your website and all the different technologies you talk about. It's awesome. I mean, you can run your business from abroad. If you're in California and own properties in another state, you know, if you have a team there on the ground and technology, you can do it. And I did it from Ecuador, was able to do that. But it comes down, you still got to have people. Like, this is not a completely armchair business. Like, up front, there's a lot of upfront effort with real estate. And so I put in the upfront effort, my business partner and I did, to build a good team, to build some good systems. We have some property management software we use, have some checklists and some operation manuals that we use. And all of that was a build up to the point to where we eventually could say, all right, now we can pay somebody else to do this work, and it still produces income, it still works, and it's still stable. So that's the work that leads up to a mini retirement or taking off and doing something else.
Yeah. Out of curiosity, what property management software are you using?
I use Buildium for our properties that we manage ourselves. Sure. I also use Cozy, which I think you encourage people to use Cozy as well for my kind of personal, my wife and I have a couple rentals personally. So Cozy's awesome. It does so many things for free. So I've really been excited about Cozy. We also use spreadsheets, just, you know, kind of Excel spreadsheets, just to manage some of the just overall, kind of put all the information together and look at it kind of in one glance.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting what you were talking about, how you learned accounting from scratch and do all that stuff yourself. That's one of those things, like, I'll be the first to admit, like, I cannot stand accounting work. Like, I'm not good at it. My brain just kind of shuts down when I have to do that stuff. But at the same time, reminds me of a conversation I was having with one of my professors when I was doing my MBA, where we were doing an accounting class, and he was telling me that he used to work for, I think it was Deloitte, doing audits and stuff on different businesses. And immediately I was just like, man, I don't think I could ever do that. That just sounds like terrible, which is, now that I think of it, kind of a rude thing to say to him. But he was saying, you know, honestly, there is no better way to become an expert at accounting and to learn everything about the ins and outs that makes a business tick than by doing audits. Like, as boring as it might seem, like, you really, really, really will learn what you're doing. And I learned through that class and another subsequent finance class that
man, like the accounting stuff is unbelievably important to like really, really understand like where is your income coming from and where are the biggest expenses and how do you really diagnose and dissect and correct the issues that come up in your business. And yeah, a lot of people just kind of want to put the blinders on because it's not fun to do that stuff. But man, right, like it will serve you so well if you can really embrace that stuff and understand how it works.
I agree. I'm 100% agree. And I think to your point, like not all of us are going to be like enjoy doing the day-to-day part of the accounting. And I think that's fine. But being able to read reports and understand reports and dig into the reports and know what it's kind of like learning to sweep the floors in a store. If you're a store owner, like you better learn how to sweep the floors and clean the bathroom first, because if you're going to hold other people accountable to do that, you've got to know how to do it. And so to me, like if you're in any entrepreneurship business, like bookkeeping is like the sweeping of the floors. Like you've got to learn that. And I still kind of stay involved, I think, just because it's the little part that I'm maintaining. I like to pay my own bills. I don't want anybody else doing that. I've heard other people outsourcing that part and losing a ton of money, and having that's where money can get stolen or you know, whatever. So I just don't want to put anybody in the temptation to do that. But it also keeps your pulse on. You know, it doesn't take a lot of time, and it's just an hour, you know, here and there. And but it keeps a pulse, like you're saying. And then it lets me then, if something's wrong, I can then pinpoint it right away, talk to people, and it keeps your mind sharp. And I compare it to, like, I'm a big Matrix fan, like the movie The Matrix. Yeah. It's kind of like the part where he saw the whole world and like little digital, like little computer signals. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I look at bookkeeping. It's like you can look at your entire real estate business and like little ones and zeros, and that's kind of how, it's like a superpower. You know, turn it around. It's not boring. This is like a cool like superhero Matrix kind of thing.
Yeah, man, that's a great analogy. That's kind of how I see it too. I never thought of it that way. Cool, man.
I'm trying hard there. I'm having to market bookkeeping. I got to do what I can do.
Yeah. So, Chaz, we kind of wrap this up. Is there any, I don't know, last advice or just words of wisdom or lessons that you've learned that you would want to share with people who are listening to this? Maybe they're like already well on their way, or they're like, man, I've got to get out of this rat race thing. Like, what do I do? Do you have any suggestions or anything you want to say to those people?
Yeah. So, I mean, the fact that you're interested in it and you're passionate about it, like that's the big first step. Like it's kind of going back to the Matrix. Like you've got the itch now, and like now you're starting to recognize all these things that are kind of wrong with the world, and you want to break free of the pattern. What I would say is, like, you know, it's that old adage of like spend the people you spend the most time with, or kind of like the average of the five people that you spend the most time with, is what your income will be, what your weight will be. Like, you know, try to start averaging up, like, you know, hanging out, you're watching a podcast, you're listening to a podcast, or you're watching this video now. Like that's what I'm a self-help, like personal growth, learn, education kind of person. Like I'm always trying to study people who I admire, who know something I don't know. And so like the more time you spend doing that, I think it's the better. Like the education and educating myself has been like the hands down the best use of my money and time, like easily, since I've started, and I continue to do it. So if you're doing that already, you know, find a person. You know, Seth's an awesome one. So if you're learning from Seth and you can stay in touch with him, you can follow his blog, you can do that. Like that's going to help you average up. You're going to find other people who are doing this, because let's be honest, like in your day-to-day world, not everybody is thinking all of this is okay. Like they might even be thinking like you're crazy. You're 30 years old and you're talking about like leaving your job at 40. Like that's nuts. Like you're why would you do that? Why would you even consider it? And yet, if you're interested in it, yeah, there's other people who are doing it, and you're going to have to sort of think outside the box and hang out with other people virtually or wherever who also have those goals. So I think that's important. It's going to make it easier, easier to implement the details, easier to learn, easier to grow as you move along.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Cool, Chad. Well, I appreciate it very much. If people want to learn more about you or get a hold of you or anything like that, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, my home online is coachcarson.com. So I write a blog there. Every week I have a newsletter, and my articles are about these topics, you know, financial independence, real estate investing, landlording. And we dive into different topics, different case studies. And then if you're interested in the book, I've got to look at my website here, but it's biggerpockets.com/retirement book. is where you can find the book. And so that's, if you buy it through Bigger Pockets, there's some bonuses that they give. I did some interviews with different people, a couple different people in the book, and had some bonus like spreadsheets and things to share with you. So if you're interested in the book, I'd love to connect with you there.
Yeah, definitely. And we'll be sure to link to that and a lot of other things that we talked about in the show notes for this, this little conversation. So, well, Chad, I appreciate your time very much. It's great to talk to you again. Chad's you too, a great, Seth. Great guy. And you going to be at FinCon again this year?
I'll be there. What about you?
Yep, be there? I'm planning on it. All right, so
let's hang out. That sounds great. Thanks for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks again, Chad. And we'll talk to y'all next time. All righty, and there you have it. That was the whole conversation with Chad and myself, and I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you got some good insights and learned a few things from him. If you want to check out the show notes for this episode, by all means, head over to the blog at retipster.com/22. That's retipster.com/22. And you can find links to all the stuff that we talked about in this episode, along with the original video from this interview that is posted over there on my YouTube channel as well. So definitely check that out. There's a lot of good stuff you can see over there. And, you know, I'd also encourage you to check out Chad's book. I was able to take a read through it. He sent me an advance copy of it a couple months before I went live because I actually got featured in his book as one of the profiles that he studies, which was really cool to be a part of that. But that book is just like packed with some really, really good insights. And I think it just does a really good job of sort of like crafting your mindset and just helping you think about real estate and early retirement with an appropriate perspective and a very realistic, practical view of how you can pull this off and how it really probably is more feasible than most people realize if you're willing to live outside your comfort zone on some level. So definitely check that book out. I enjoyed it a lot. And you want to hear what else I enjoy? I enjoy having you here with me. It's great to have at least a few listening ears out there. And I'm really, really hopeful that you're getting something out of this and that you're learning new things along the way. Thanks again for being awesome. I appreciate you so much. And I'll talk to you again in the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the RE Tipster Podcast. For a full summary of this episode, stocked with links, show notes, and a lot more, check out the podcast archive page at retipster.com/podcast.